From ancient Greece to the present day, we have been fascinated with how the human body works, how we function, what makes us sick, and how we can improve our health and prolong our life, perhaps forever if we're lucky. Sometimes we read about antiquated remedies for illnesses that don't exist anymore, and it's kind of tempting to laugh them off as something that people did in the, quote, dark ages, unquote. But is our understanding really any better these days? What'll happen to the things we think of as diseases and treatments today when it's seen through the prism of a century or two from now? My next guest has pondered the same questions. He's even written a book about it. Mike McRae is a science writer, author of the book called Unwell, What Makes a Disease a Disease. Mike, you say we've got to understand the social and cultural nature of disease. It's vital that we do so. Why is it vital?
If you think about how we actually interpret, you know, what makes people sick and what we do to respond to that, so whether it's a prognosis, where are you going with this in the future, how's it going to affect you, or what sort of treatments we do, these occur in cultural settings. So if you look throughout history, it's not like people had smaller brains and were less intelligent, or even had, you know, I guess, different takes on diseases. You know, there were still things that made you sick. We had very different understanding of how to actually interpret the body in a way that was bad or broken. And even across the world today, you know, diseases are not the same in each and every country.
No.
So there's a cultural context to diagnosing and to actually understanding what to do about people's bodies when they're unwell.
A really sad reminder, just as you were speaking then, came to my head, and that was the really stark contrast between how the spread of AIDS and HIV was viewed in the West and some developing countries, where it's still believed in some quarters to be witchcraft.
Oh, absolutely. If you go to Africa and actually have a look throughout there, how to actually deal with HIV. But even the very start of HIV in America, it took years to respond to that. If this was any other condition, there would have been a pretty quick response, I feel, to researching this horrid condition that was being observed to arise. And yet because it was seen as, you know, as a gay disease, as a disease that homosexuals were getting, it was pretty readily dismissed. There's a famous press conference that took place in the White House, where there was one reporter who actually asked about HIV, and the White House spokesperson, you know, basically ridiculed it because it was considered to be a gay disease. It wasn't until it was actually a young boy who got HIV through a blood transfusion did the world actually sit up and start to take notice. Now, that's a cultural thing. You know, HIV being what it is, it's, you know, it is a virus that affects bodies no matter what, no matter who you are, but it has a cultural context to it. It's associated with this stigma. And so the cultural setting for diseases is incredibly important, where we want to understand how to respond to them and you know, what do we want to do in terms of devoting resources to them?
Well, Mike, in some ways, I think the story that you tell very close to the front of the book about your own family is a case in point, because I really love the way you've broken this book up into things like broken, infected, insane, abnormal, then we get dead, and then the final sort of subsection is well, which I think is fantastic. We end on a positive note there. But in the broken section at the very front of the book, you actually talk about your own family.
Yeah, it's interesting because it didn't start off that way. When I initially wrote it, being a science writer, I was very removed from the whole process. There's a thing we do in science where we want to be objective. And so we remove ourselves from the picture and we look at it standing on the outside, looking in. And being a science writer, I'm quite used to doing that. And my background is in science. You know, I started off in pathology many years ago, working in a laboratory. And you look at disease from a removed perspective. You want to understand it in terms of biochemistry and genetics, you know, broken bones and muscles that don't work properly. And so when I first wrote it had a little bit more of a textbook sort of feel to it.
Right.
And I guess I didn't identify myself as being unwell, you know, in any way. I still don't. I still sometimes feel like maybe I'm a tourist in this way, you know, talking about the human body in these ways when I don't look at myself and consider myself as having a disease or a disorder.
And yet.
But then you know, when I then went back and had a look at it, I realized that if I'm to do this justice, I have to understand that this is a human condition that we all have something to do with. You know, we all have friends, family, ourselves who go through times where we don't consider ourselves well, where we do feel broken. And so I had to go through and really reevaluate everything, and it was eye-opening for me, you know, to sort of start looking at people around me who I don't consider in any way to be broken.
No.
Have little breaks. You know, there's little things there, and it's not the front of my mind.
Well, do you mind if we get specific about this? Can we start with you, actually, and what you discovered sort of later in life about your own supposed shortcomings?
Absolutely. It's interesting, in my mid-20s, I started to discover that I've actually got a condition called prosopagnosia, and I share that with quite a few people. Good old Dr. Carl Krusielniski of ABC science fame, he has this, and you know, it's
basically face blindness, isn't it?
Face blindness. I can't remember a face to save my life, but I just thought my brain didn't work well. You know, it was one of those things. I was a bit slower than other people. I couldn't remember a name. And when I became a teacher, having to remember the students who are all sitting in particular positions, I was shocking at it. And I'm still to this day shocking. I can't remember a face. Someone will come up to me, and if they recognize me, I've got a couple of seconds to start putting together the pieces, thinking, who are you? Where do I know you?
Didn't at one stage a small boy come up to you dressed in your son's clothes?
My partner and my son were in a shopping center, and I didn't expect them to be there. And they walk right up to me, and it took me a second. And I think it's just moments like that where you just click and think, most people seem to get this quite quickly. And that's the thing, I'm only inside my own head. I only have my own experiences. But apparently this doesn't happen to people. Most people would see their son from a distance and go, that's my son. The first recognition was, oh, that looks like my son's shirt. And then it was like, oh, that is my son. And they were standing in front of me. And it was just that putting together those pieces that was quite difficult. Now, I wouldn't consider that a disorder. Like, it doesn't really inhibit my life in any real way. But I have also had depression throughout my life, which is quite a ubiquitous thing in this day and age. And, you know, I've had troubles with that and, you know, gone to therapy, used medications, found various ways to deal with that. But once again, I don't think I've ever really sat and looked at it in that way to say, how does this affect my life? You know, what do I have that I can consider being a disease, disorder, syndrome, condition? And then I've got a whole group of people around me. My partner has ADD, and she's, you know, an adult female. And that's not usually what you think about when you think about ADD. You don't think about professional adult women. You think about recalcitrant teenage boys who don't sit still. And she was diagnosed later in life. And that diagnosis has helped her immensely. The fact that she can say, my brain works differently. How do I deal with these differences in ways that can be positive and can help me? But what's interesting, and I think this sort of formed, I guess, a lot of the basis of the book, is as her partner dealing with this condition, there's also a side of me that still holds on to blame. You know, there's still these moments where she won't close a cupboard door, where she'll, you know, leave her phone at home, where she'll leave the cup out on the couch. You know, she'll leave her shoes in front of the couch. She'll just get frustrated, kind of say, can't you just put these away? Can't you, you know, learn to do these things? And she forgets, you know, she's distracted by something.
Hey, Mike, you don't have to have ADD to be really annoying in those areas. I've got teenage daughters. It's interesting, isn't it? Everyone has a perspective on what's abnormal and normal, what's a disease and what's not, which is, of course, at the very heart of your book. Let's talk about homesickness or nostalgia. Yes. How was it viewed back in the olden days, Mike?
Well, you go back a few centuries, and you know, if you have your soldiers who are far from home and, you know, they're invading another land, and nostalgia was considered for a very long time to be not just a whimsical wishing you were still having your mum's lamb roast. This was something that was actually considered a deadly condition. Joseph Banks actually wrote about nostalgia in his diary.
And this is the botanist for everybody on the Cook's, you know, circumnavigating of the world, including discovering Australia, at least from a European point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And he, you know, he wrote about this devilish condition called nostalgia, and it was considered extremely serious. Now, the context at the time was that there was a lot of study through French literature about these conditions of the memory. Now, we don't talk too much about it these days, but there was a trend to look at the mind and memory as being potentially pathological. And so nostalgia was one of these sorts of things where you would have soldiers in other land and missing home to the point that it would affect their organs. It might actually affect their state of health to the point that it was actually considered deadly. Now, we don't think of that these days. And, you know, it's an interesting question. Why? Why is it that you don't go along to the doctor and the doctor says, we need to quickly whisk you into our hospital and let's look up the Medicare code?
You have acute nostalgia. Yeah.
Exactly. We'd better get you a treatment for that. And there's several possibilities. One is the world is a lot smaller. Maybe we just don't feel nostalgia like we used to. The other possibility is it just never really existed in that way.
But that's the point, isn't it, though, Michael? I mean, you make the point here that it's our cultural database at the time that informs our perception of what's wrong and what's not wrong.
So
this is a collection, a distillation of symptoms that someone in a well-regarded medical profession in various countries around the world at the time defined as nostalgia, a fatal disease that could involve organ failure. If we can move on, though, to another one, and again, a little bit of a warning here. These are serious adult concepts, even though we may be being a little flippant about them, but women's hysteria.
Yeah. That's been worn around for many, many centuries. I mean, you go back to ancient Greece, and that's where the origins of hysteria can be found, at least in written down. And you're right. I mean, we poke fun at it, but for a very long time, these were considered extremely serious conditions. And if you look at the concept of hysteria being, what hysterectomy is, removal of the uterus. So hysteria relates to the moving of the uterus through the body. And when they used to do anatomical dissections, organs moved around, and they go, well, where does these things sit? And they thought, well, maybe the uterus moves and that's responsible for women acting not as you want a woman to act. But you think about that, that's really where this lies, is a cultural value to say, well, women are not expected to be overly emotional. Women are expected to actually be somewhat subservient. When you're not, well, there's two things. One, either you're to blame, or two, maybe there's a physiological cause. And so they look to the physiological cause and they went, well, your uterus needs to be doing what it should do. And there's various ways that have been proposed throughout time that we can do that. One is pop a baby in it, because that's what a uterus should be doing. Or maybe you can actually fool it into sitting still. There was one physician who would actually suggest coaching it back into place by using nice smelling herbs and stuff. So all of them had something to do with pulling that uterus back into place. It kind of disappeared for a while during the Middle Ages. It wasn't a big thing. And part of that may actually be related to how we viewed women in the Middle Ages. It wasn't quite like it was in Romantic times. Women were allowed to actually enjoy sex in the Middle Ages. If anything, they were the temptresses. They were, much more, sexual people. But when it slipped back again in later centuries into women not being allowed to be sexual, again, this whole concept of hysteria, where you had somebody else who had to bring your uterus back into place, came up. And so during the 19th century, it became this big thing to say, well, maybe you can just put a baby in it, or maybe they just need to have what's called a paroxysm. Now, paroxysms these days, you can sort of think about your old bodice ripper sort of novels. But back then it was women aren't allowed to have orgasms. They don't have one of those. They have a paroxysm. It's a fit. And it's a spasm of the uterus that for all purposes is an orgasm, but they don't, they're not meant to enjoy it. And so again, this whole idea of bringing that uterus back into place because a woman is not acting as we expect a woman to act.
She is being unacceptable. So we will mend her. We will mend her by letting this release come through what we now call an orgasm. But correct. In those times was something else again. Very quickly, Mike, because we're running out of time, and it's a fascinating concept. I really enjoy talking about it. But do you think obesity, which I think is now recognised as a disease in our psychological sort of journal, the Bible called the DSM, do you think in 100 years' time we'll be discussing that as one of those flippant flights of fancy?
I think we'll understand a lot more conditions as being far more complex than we understand now. We love to give categories to things, and someone comes along and says, here's my suffering, and they say, well, let's look up this criteria, and you belong in this box. We're going to understand the personalized context, I think, of disease far more in the future, where we'll say, there is suffering going on. What is the rich complexity of issues here, and how can we work with the person who is suffering to help improve? So it becomes more of a conversation. It becomes more about understanding their genes that are particular to them, their microflora in their gut, all of these things that are particular. So the idea that obesity was a single condition is going to fall by the wayside, and I think in the future, medicine is going to become far more personalised.
That's our prediction from Mike McRae, a science writer and author of a book called Unwell, What Makes a Disease a Disease. Mike, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
This is Life Matters.